Good morning, everyone. I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you, Sheila. Thank you, committee. I'm always so honored to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. From the animal that came here off the streets to the rich life I enjoy today, I'm just the raw miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Are there any newcomers in the room? Anybody new in your first? Welcome. And anyone else that may be afraid to introduce him or herself, because I did not, I pray with every fiber of my being that you find the miracle that I found here. There should be another speaker up here today. I should not have lived this long. And I just, embrace Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship unlike anything else in the history of the world. I don't think there ever was or ever will be or is today. The joy, the love, the support, the patience, the tolerance, the love, and the kindness that we offer one to another. God's great melting pot of kids is what we are. I have some treasures in my life, and I think I'm going to, this is not normal for me to do. Early in my sobriety, in fact, it was a year and 3 months before I ever opened my mouth in Alcoholics Anonymous, before I even read anything. I'll probably tell you about that later if God sends it through. I left my first speaker's meeting because I was too nervous for the person sharing. It was incomprehensible that anybody could stand up in front of you and talk and have all those eyes staring back at her. And I got so terribly nervous, I actually left the room. And so I never know when I'm asked to do this awesome thing, what's going to come through, because I immediately turn it over. And I'm very fond of sharing with people. If I did this well with all areas of my life, I probably would be in a little less trouble than I get into at times. If everything was so fully surrendered to God, life would be a lot easier, I'm sure. Anyway, my treasures include today a satisfactory conscious partnership with my very own God in the entire business of living. God in my middle, my great friend within. And let me tell you, there was nothing but Diane when I got here. I had run my own life. I went unto myself. Don't ask for help. Don't admit any sign of weakness that you don't know something. And so you can imagine the challenge that Alcoholics Anonymous presented to me. So that I have my great friend within, wherever I go, he is. And he doesn't test me or set me up or, move me like a puppet. He is there to love and support me and to give me all I need in terms of strength and wisdom, if I will allow it, if I don't have him in the deep freeze that he was in for the first 30 plus years of my life. I also have a sobriety date that should not have happened. I was told I'd be dead by June of 1974, and I entered the hallowed halls of Alcoholics Anonymous on August the 30th, 1974, and I have never left. I didn't get on the firing lines right away, but from the moment of commitment, which is my third great treasure, the acquiring of a sponsor on February the 18th, 1975, I have never backed off or gone away. I have been led by tremendous leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only has my sponsor and her sister, when she moved to Grants Pass, my first sponsor, Pat, I acquired her sister, Peggy. Pat came in February of 1971. In fact, she acquired me on her fourth sobriety birthday. I'm not sure what a present I was. I'd heard her say to Peggy in some of my forays in and out of that women's meeting, God, whoever gets that one better have a lot of time. I was no nice customer around here. And yet when I stood trembling in front of her, knowing she was going to reject me, knowing she wasn't, I didn't do rejection. I didn't let you or anybody else reject me. I got out first. And yet I stood in front of her without any answers, just broken, absolutely broken, for the first time in my life. And I asked her to sponsor me. And she took me in her arms and welcomed me to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and immediately began to give me some very strong suggestions and some very firm direction, which I'm sure God will let me get to later. But so that was the tremendous moment of commitment for me, the single most awesome miracle kind of thing I'd ever done in my life. Never in a little over 30 years that I'd ever asked anybody for help. and I completely laid myself bare in front of her and began to follow direction. And then that home group, she was a part of a home group, a strong home group. And that's my fourth miracle, my fourth treasure. I still call it's now in Cupertino, it's moved a couple times, but the Cupertino Women's Meeting on Tuesdays at 6:30 is my home group. And I am there no matter what. And it is in that group that I've learned about Alcoholics Anonymous and about service in Alcoholics Anonymous and about giving to others, working with others. And gosh, they've let me be secretary, they've let me be treasurer, they've let me be chip girl. They have let me be intergroup rep. They've let me be general service representative. They've let me be hospital and institution representative over all these many years. But my most favorite job, my most favorite service position ever was that of greeter. And I was a few years sober when they let me be greeter. And it was really scary because I was not sure anybody coming through that door would want to shake my hand or didn't shake hands, hug me. I'm all for hugs. And boy, let me tell you something else. I got to know the people in that group, and I got to be the beacon of light at the door, the God light at the door. And I didn't let anybody escape. And I can't think of anything that warmed my heart more filled me with joy was in getting to be greeter of my home group. And then my other great treasure, of course, is my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have always had a very firm commitment. For me, the pearl of great price has been sponsorship. It's a miracle that anybody ever wanted me to sponsor them, let alone sponsor me. And every girl that calls me sponsor, I have to kind of chuckle because what they give to me is far greater than what I give to them. Anytime a girl has ever sponsored or shared with me, has allowed me to sponsor her, I've learned so much about myself. What an incredible opportunity to learn about me. They have shared that pearl of great price, their innermost secrets. And in doing so, they've opened caverns, deep caverns, in things that I've buried from way in my past that didn't even come to light in my first inventory. So sponsorship is and always will be the great joy and the great pearl. I've had very firm commitments always to Alcoholics Anonymous, starting with intergroup and then general service. And now the thing that gives me great joy, and that's the Hospital Institution Committee carrying the message of hope, actually getting carried the message of hope too in the various institutions that I'm privileged to enter today. I go into Salinas Valley State Prison, level 4. I go into CTF Soledad State Prison, levels 2 and 3. These are all men, and they love us women coming in. Mariposa Women's Lodge. I'm currently sponsoring a brand new woman. She's 75 years old, and she's been drinking for 45 years and trying to get sober for 30. And God just placed her firmly in my path when I didn't have an extra hour in my day. And I simply said to him, okay, you give me the woman, you give me the time too, and I know that. And then I go into Elmwood Jail. And in both Mariposa and Elmwood Jail, I meet myself coming and going, because this is where I should be spending it, should have spent a lot more time than I did. I'm one of these that didn't get caught, and the cops weren't where I was doing my crime. Otherwise, there's a good chance I would still be locked up back east somewhere. So this miracle that came to Alcoholics Anonymous off the streets, more animal than human, with a few traces of human, I'd say, but more animal, didn't start out that way. What it used to be like was pretty dreadful. There's no doubt in my mind that an alky was born when I was born. I had the ism. Because as a child, I was unruly. I was incorrigible. I defied my parents at every turn. I did not want to speak the English language, so I made up my own. I didn't necessarily want to stay home at night, so I would run away. Sometimes I would deliberately get lost and then scare myself a bit, although I was fearless. Other times I would simply hide someplace and let my parents search for me all night. And the one that I remember the best was hiding in the rabbit's cage while my parents and their search party were just combing the hills where we lived. We lived in a rather rural area. And almost gleefully letting them be frantic. And when I was finally discovered near dawn, they were not happy. And that led to a boarding of my bedroom windows and a deadbolt on my bedroom door. And that led to me tearing my bedroom apart and doing a few things that I've shared with some of the women I sponsor. But if you want to use your imagination, I painted my walls. And that was the kind of kid I was. We moved into a populated area so that I could start school. And I was immediately kicked out of kindergarten because I wouldn't speak English. Then I began running with what I call baby gangs, elementary school gangs. And I was the leader of my gang. And as such, we had our clubhouse, and we fought the other gangs. And I think the doctor counted 16 trips to the hospital later. I had lacerations, smashed fingers, you name it, doing battle as a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old kid with the other gangs in the neighborhood. It soon became apparent to the families that lived where we lived that running around or getting near Diane was a definite problem. And little by slow, I lost friendships so that, you know, there weren't many playmates left for me. And my parents were beside themselves, just beside themselves, because these were wonderful people. I came in a family that was absolutely warm and loving and supportive, nurturing. My mom would sit down beside my bed sometimes at night and just look imploringly at me, pleadingly, Diane, what is it? What can I do? And I had no clue. I had no clue. I had this demon inside of me, this black, ugly fester that absolutely ruled me and compelled me to just do things that were naughty, that were bad. And I never could figure out why. I was just tormented all the time. I didn't like living in my own skin. I felt like the world was out to get me, that it was unfair. I could be on the playground if there were a group of people talking over there. They were talking about me, and it wasn't good. People didn't like me. I knew that. They didn't have to tell me. I just knew it. And the bottom line was I really didn't like myself much. And again, I had no clue about what that was about. I simply was uncomfortable in my own skin. However, getting into junior high school, I discovered sports. Actually, I had done a bit of running in elementary school, but in junior high school, I really dove into athletics. And I think this is what kept me out of the sea of alcoholism through school, because I come by it honestly. I've got world-class athletes as parents, both my mom and my dad, and so I'm naturally talented athletically, and I went for it full bore, track and swimming predominantly. But I was out there on the field in the pool every single day after school and not getting home until late. And I think that the endorphins, those natural good feeler guys that athletics create, kept me out of that sea, kept me out of that ism, didn't help me like myself any better. I had to win in order for me to be happy with myself. And then often when I'd win a track meet or win a swimming competition, it was not fast enough, so I was still not happy. But it was, it got me all the way through school and actually all the way through college and into my first year out of college, which is when I finally met booze. I had been given a fabulous teaching position. You know, I did well in school, too. I got good head. In spite of all my demons, I was a very excellent student in school. And that still baffles me today because I had zero study habits, absolutely zero. I got by just on my brains, because I had no sense of discipline whatsoever. And my first year and out of school, I'm allowed to teach in a high school, and I'm not even degreed to do that yet. I'm going to school at night to get that degree. I'm back with my old high school principal. I'm back with my old high school synchronized swimming teacher. I'm back with my old high school Spanish teacher, the man I loved more than anything. He was the teacher of teachers. I speak Spanish fluently today. And I was his prize student. And here I am back there teaching. And I've got Spanish classes, and I have English classes, and I have synchronized swimming classes. I have a load. I have like 175 kids. And I have to be perfect, and I have to be the best teacher, and they all have to like me, and their parents have to like me. And I am just driven that entire year. And besides doing the very best kind of, you know, I mean, I just had to really, I would go to some lengths to reach out to kids that were challenged, that were acting naughty in my classes. I remember one girl was just, Karen was just, she didn't have much of a IQ, and she was, well, I ended up going to her home and finding out that her mother was a prostitute, and her dad was at San Quentin, and her brother was in a road camp. Kid had no chance at all. So, you know, on weekends, I took her to Knott's Berry Farm, I took her to Disneyland, I brought her home. You know, I created a friend, so that she became teacher's helper rather than teacher's tyrant. I did stuff like that, but I burnt the candle at both ends. And then when my high school swimming teacher had back problems and I inherited the synchronized swimming show, and everybody had to do that perfectly, I reached it where I just broke. And I can remember this afternoon, this evening, as if it were yesterday. I can still see my living room, and I can still remember the feeling, because I was just ready to explode. It was April of my first year of teaching. I had grades due. The synchronized swimming show was the following weekend. And, you know, I had one class. Oh, this was a kick. I had one class, a low-ability English class. It was right after lunch, their lunch, and my swimming. So I'd be in the pool with the girls, and I'd come to the class soaking wet with my little short hair, little like I am, and I would be inheriting these kids. And there were 35 of them, 25 guys and 10 girls, and they were a bunch of kids that had failed sophomore and junior English or were so low ability, like Tom Picarello couldn't spell his own name. Well, I couldn't spell Picarello easily either. But anyway, they'd come in from lunch, and the room would just reek of booze and cigarettes, just reek. And they were really challenged kids. Most of them were taking, I mean, John Muchow was taking English for the third time. I thought that was criminal, that he had to take sophomore English for the third time. He just hadn't passed it. So, of course, they were never going to fail in my class. And some of these kids couldn't even write, and they had this routine for these kids, writing essays. And so I just cheated for them. I fell right into it. I changed answers on their tests. I helped them write their essays. I mean, we just soared this class. And the district took notice, and they thought, my God, this is a miracle teacher. It's just, and they didn't know. I was just right in there with them. And they asked us to do a seminar after school. I told the kids, okay, you guys, you know what's up here. You know what we have to do. Well, we even faked that. They just thought, you know, that I had done miracles, and all I'd done was cheat for them. Although I didn't call it that. I just called it help, because nobody was going to get lower than a C in any class I taught. So there I was, and I think on this particular eventful evening, I had a bunch of their papers to change, correct, fix, because it took a lot of work, that erasing and rewriting. I don't know how I got away with it, trying to emulate their writing, their handwriting. Oh, my God, did I go to the lengths. Anyway, I walked in my living room, and I was ready to explode. I was so angry about particularly three girls that were doing a trio in this swim show that, well, one of them couldn't swim because it was that time of the month. My God, I swam at any time of the month. Give me a break. I was just furious. And I remember I came home, and I don't know where it came from. I went to the cupboard, pulled out the bottle of vodka, pulled out some roses, lime juice, fixed a gimlet, and my whole world changed. Oh, my God. It just went through my body like a magic elixir, and I could not believe it. Now, I'd gone that long without, my mom had said to me at 16, when her brother died of alcoholism, I have it on both sides of the family, Diane A., be careful. Be careful when you start to drink. She'd seen the ism, I'm sure. She'd identified my Uncle George's personality, my personality. I completely forgot that. It was magical. And I had class that night. I was facing finals at Long Beach State. I had the synchronized swimming show. I had 175 kids' grades to make sure we're all C's or better. I was busy, and I was getting maybe 2 to 3, maybe 4 hours sleep max a night. And I had a second gimlet, and I remember I just sailed off to class. All of a sudden, the care button was broken, and it was no big deal, none of it. And I immediately was in trouble. And within a week, my friends were saying, "Diane, what's the matter with you?" I'd be at a party, and I'd be drunk. I dove in. There was no gradual ebbing in. And I got through that school year. I got the grades done, the swim show done, my degree, and I took off. I had gotten a really neat scholarship to study at Notre Dame for Spanish teachers. I took off and I'd had a hostage, by the way. I'd had a guy since I was 15, 16, and went off to Notre Dame for the summer. They paid us. It was a government grant. It was incredible. But there I just drank, and found a new hostage, another Spanish teacher from New Jersey. And by the end of the summer, I had marched back to Long Beach saying, goodbye, everybody. I'm moving east. Broke my teaching contract, broke the guy with the guy I've been with all since I was 15. I'm now 22. Broke everybody's heart. I remember saying to my parents, I'm going. I'm leaving all of this behind. I really had come to believe through my alcoholism, through my drinking, that the problem lay in Long Beach, where I've been born, raised, educated. It was all your fault. And if I went 3,000 miles away to New Jersey, I would be free from this burden. And of course, you, as you all well know, I took the problem well localized between my ears with me. But what I did to family and friends in that brief amount of time was tragic. Absolutely tragic. I didn't care about anything at all. I really literally left everything behind and took a suitcase with me and headed east. As you might well imagine, the new hostage turned out to be pretty lame. And I began a period of a little over 10 years in which care button not only was broken, so I had no conscience. And I went from being a kid raised in a really decent, nice home to being a criminal. Streets, on the streets and off the streets. I've been tied up and locked down and put away in northern New Jersey and in New York City, along the way in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and in southern and northern California. I absolutely did not care about you or your life as long as I could get from you what I needed. And I took a series of men and a series of hostages and jobs. And, you know, some of this, I could not believe I could ever talk about it. In fact, I was sure when I took my fourth step, my sponsor would not be able to listen to it and survive, that she'd faint, run from the room, throw up, tell me to get out. And yet, her sharing back with me, her wisdom, her understanding was so amazing. And I never thought that I'd get past when I sobered up the guilt, the shame of what I'd done. Along the way, I was driving very, very drunk one day. There were very icy roads in the winter in northern New Jersey. And I lost control of my car. Now, it was the icy roads' fault, you understand. It was not the fact that I just left the bar middle of the day. And I was very drunk. It was maybe 4 in the afternoon. And I, last thing I remember, I was headed for a bus bench, and there was a woman and her daughter on it. At least it was a woman and a little girl. And when I woke up in the hospital, I remember looking first to see if there was a cop. I'd killed 2 people. And I hear today in Alcoholics Anonymous, my husband's sponsor, Tom, killed 2 people the same way. I missed them. They got off that bench, seconds and inches, seconds and inches. I didn't miss the bench or the thing that was there. And, you know, at that point in my life, I just wanted to be dead. I was seriously, seriously injured, and they needed to do surgery, and they could not even operate on me for a half a month because I was so emaciated. I'd been drinking so much. I was covered with massive bruises. Whites of my eyes were yellow. I weighed 85 pounds, and there was just no way. I had smashed up my insides, and they had to do a whole resectioning, it's a big old long word, but at any rate, they tried to build me up with, they had needles in my arm so that they could do the surgery. And what I remember is the current hostage, there was always one, came in and he told me, you know, when you're all better, when you recover, I'm going to take you on this really neat cruise. And I snarled at him. I said, you're not taking me anywhere unless you get me some booze. I need my vodka, 100 proof. And he looked at me, he was horrified, horrified. There's nurses, there's doctors, you know, there's... And I said, because they were never giving me enough of anything in that hospital. And I threatened him. And, you know, he went out and bought the pint of 100 proof vodka, with the straw. The night before the surgery, I was drinking. I'm still mystified by the fact that the hospital didn't pick up on that. That nobody somehow figured out or smelled it or tested it or something. I still don't know. But when I look back on the miracles in my life, when I talk about being a miracle, you got to believe I was, because I should not have survived. And that's not the worst of it. I come out of this double major surgery they call it, and I still have a scar from my breastbone down to my pelvic bone. I mean, I went huge long. They opened me up and... I had tubes down my nose, and I had needles in both arms, and they were on boards so that, you know, I wouldn't dislodge them, you know. And I was in a tremendous amount of pain, and they were giving me whatever, but it was never enough. And this same poor hostage comes in, and I'm saying, I need my vodka, and he's now he is double horrified. Now it's like, no way. And again, I'm threatening him, I want it or else. Now, my mother has launched herself upon me, my poor little mommy, my mommy love, who is just, boy, oh boy, greater love hath no woman on planet Earth than my mom had for me. And she's there, too. So we've got her and the doctors and the nurses and the orderlies and the stuff they're already giving me. I'm not supposed to be taking anything by mouth. That's why the tubes are down my nose, because of the surgery. And I actually ingested 100 proof vodka through the straw. And this poor guy actually did it. When I think about that today, I realize even more what a miracle I am. Because why did I live through that? Whatever they were giving me was pretty powerful pain stuff, I'm sure. And yet, I wanted more, and it was never enough. It was never enough. Miraculously, I was released from that hospital, and probably one of the meanest, most horrible things, I couldn't talk about this for years, my mommy drove me home to my little hovel, and she cleaned it up. It was pretty disastrous, and she cleaned it out, and all of my stuff was gone. And I just erupted at her, just had a major volcanic eruption, a rage attack like I had never had. And I literally threw her out of my house, sent her packing after she'd been hovering at the hospital for 2 weeks, sent her packing, and marched out of there. And I had this huge corset-like thing on me because of this huge surgery, and wasn't supposed to drive a car. And I got out and got in my car and went to the liquor store and got my 100-proof vodka and maybe a few bottles of it. Started drinking it before I even got home. Now, mind you, they've been giving me other stuff for pain. You know, they sent me home with pain stuff, of course. So the combination of the two landed me. I woke up in the snow, passed out. Again, I should have died. I'm passed out somewhere between the garage and the door of my little place. And... again, I wake up and I'm not frozen to death, and I get back inside my house. And so it wasn't too long after that episode that I realized that people in northern New Jersey had really had enough of me. I didn't really have any friends. I certainly didn't have a job. And it took a lot of courage to come back to California because of what I had done. What I had done to my friends and what I had done to my family. But again, you know, love of family. Family love is just amazing. And the fact that my mom and dad and sisters took me back with open arms and did everything they could. But I was so far into my disease at this point that I resisted and resented all of the help that I was being offered. And I was not able to stay in California, in Southern California, for very long. I simply acquired a new hostage, and when he got transferred up to Santa Clara Valley, I came with him. And the miracle for me happened within just a very short months of reaching the Santa Clara Valley. I, again, should not have been alive. I was at absolutely the bottom of the well, drinking around the clock, and not able to, you know, I was living with this guy, not able to really even settle into this apartment that we had. And I don't know, the hand of God, my cousin dragged me to her doctor. I'd looked at myself, and I'd seen the bruises, and I'd seen the whites in my eyes, and I knew I could not remember night into day, day into night, and you know, I'd go out to get my vodka, and I'd you know, fall down the stairs and lacerate my legs, and I'd get in the car and get lost and end up in downtown San Jose going the wrong way in a one-way street, and, you know, I had altercations with the cops, and it was tedious, it was tough, and I remember her dragging me into this doctor's office, and this great big ex-Marine MD guy, I walked in there, I didn't even get a chance to sit down, and he just blasted me with, you know what, baby, you're an alcoholic. And I've been told that before. And I challenged them every time, defiant. And he said, you know, I don't even think you're going to live till June. This was January of 74. I don't think you've got even months to live. But I'm going to do a liver function study, and we'll see where we are. And he did, and it was the worst he'd ever seen. And he said, I still think that let's try to send you to detox and take care of you. And instead, I put my tail between my legs and took my bottle of vodka out from underneath the seat of my car and drove home and defiantly said to him, how dare he? How dare he? But by April of that year, I was absolutely unable to get off of a couch. And day went into night, night went into day, and I was not eating, and I really was about as far gone as anyone could be without being dead. And somehow I got myself down to Alcoholic Services to a fabulous woman named Dr. Terrell, who was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she took me to a detox up in San Leandro. And I even tried to escape from there. She got me there, and I wanted out. I needed to go. I said, I need to have dinner first before you. And, of course, I hadn't eaten in 18 months, probably. And they got me in the backside with a needle. And that is all I remember on that Friday. I remember opening my eyes a time or two on Saturday and Sunday. And I had the strangest series of creatures running around that room there on the walls and on the ceiling. And they were all furry, and they were gray, and they were green, and they were red. They were every color in the book, and they were every shape, and they just didn't identify with any. I mean, it was bizarre. Or someone would come into my room to do something for me, and they'd grow one of these on their hands or on their nose. I suppose that was part of whatever they were doing to keep me from dying from DTs. But the great event happened on Monday night. To two gals there at the place at the time, came for me and made me put on my filthy, dirty bathrobe and bedroom slippers. And they led me down a hallway into a room full of light. In that room, there were these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed people. And they were all talking at the same time. And they were laughing, and I didn't laugh. And they were there. And the inmates, we were here. And they were the Hospital and Institution Committee of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you can see why I love H&I today. They found me. I had never, ever, ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never seen you guys. In all the times I was locked up, tied down, put away, I'd never met AA. Well, I must tell you, I thought you were really dumb and lame. I sat there like this. In my dark world, you didn't tell anybody anything, no matter what. And you guys were sharing this stuff. I mean, it was appalling. I mean, I was ashamed for you that you would air your dirty laundry the way you were airing it. But I was amazed. And the other people locked up with me were really willing to share, but not Diane. I wouldn't even, I would say Diane pass, and I would give you the ugliest, dirtiest look I could. But, you know, I was falling in love with you. Anyway, I was intrigued by you, but I wasn't going to let you know that because nobody had ever gotten close to me in my dark world. Even the hostages, the men that I took, didn't get close to me. You know, you ask the ones that, you know, are somewhere around today, and they'll tell you it was like being around a refrigerator. I mean, I was really, really walled off. I don't know how many times I experienced the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous before I was thrown out of that detox. They had to let me go for bad behavior. It was no better than when I was a kid. The negative attention I loved, so I wouldn't eat meals. I had a volcanic eruption. They brought in this nice little doctor from Mill Valley, Dr. Gill, to do a chalk talk. And I went ballistic because he was in front of my television set and I wanted to watch all my children. And it was a Friday, and Erica was in high drama. And, you know, I met Erica in 1970 when I was locked up. And my little inmate was watching all my children. And it was the very start of it in January of 70, I was locked up. And I've been watching it on and off drunks, in between drunks, or when I wasn't passed out, ever since. So, you know, this is almost... Well, it's only 4 years later, I guess. But I become really bonded to Erica. And I really couldn't miss. And, you know, the detox, they really, it was their fault they let me watch it. But I think when I was sitting in front of the TV for an hour, at least I wasn't into trouble. And I wasn't trying to get the other inmates there to get into trouble. Because I did really, really naughty stuff that I didn't have time for today. But I just as well might have been back in my 3, 4, 5 when I was... getting into it, getting mauled by the chow dog, clawed by the Siamese cat, running away from home, hiding. I was doing that kind of stuff. So they called Dr. Terrell, and they sent her to come get me. She was not happy and took me home. And, of course, I was an island unto myself. I didn't need help. I'd gotten this little bit of information. I mean, I'd never tried to stop drinking. It was medicinal. Why should I stop drinking? It was my magic elixir. It broke my care button and destroyed my conscience, which I hadn't gotten yet. So I came home and dove right immediately back into the sea of alcohol. I tried to control my drinking for a minute. It was boring. It cost too much money. Little can, prefab cans, there's no booze in them anyway. And I went back out after a morning and bought my 100-proof vodka. And, you know... Between May, though, and August of 1974, it was pretty bleak because you guys had penetrated my soul, and nothing I did I got away with. So on August the 30th, I came crawling back, first to Dr. Terrell. And let me tell you about you guys. You know, she's pretty disgusted because I've been made a scene up there, and she had to take me out and throw me, you know. And I go crawling into her office, and she welcomes me. And she says to me, we need to reinstitutionalize you. And I say, get this one, I say, no, I think I need to suffer to get well this time. I didn't suffer. I needed help. I need to suffer. Now, this is Memorial Labor Day weekend. And she's very concerned, and I'm determined. I said, just let me know where those AA meetings are. And she gave me a packet of pills, and she gave me a meeting schedule. And I went straight away to you guys and got wrapped in that cloak of love. And sure didn't need to take anything. You guys did it all. Reported back to her on Tuesday after Labor Day. Waited for her outside of her office and with her pills. I was going to give her back her pills. And she didn't come. And finally... A really nice guy came up to me and asked me if I were waiting for her, and I said yes. And he said, well, honey, she's not coming. And it took me a minute to absorb that. And he said, I really don't want to, I hate to tell you this, but she has terminal cancer, and her last day was Friday. And you were the last person she saw. And oh, man. You know, I was going to stay sober for Dr. Terrell at that point. You know, I know that's not how we do it, but I sat there so devastated. I had not cried since I was 7, right? I mean, I'd shown emotion to anybody boy, don't be vulnerable. Ugh, don't be vulnerable. And the tears started to well up in my eyes, and I didn't get the real good ball till after my fifth step, but I was so decimated. And he asked me if he could help me, and I said, no, I'm just going to go to AA. So back I came, and that began my little sojourn of 6 months in which I just couldn't get close to you. You know, the pride on one hand and the fear, because I had done so many really, really naughty stuff. And I knew no matter what I heard from this podium that you guys would not get what I had done. And so, you know, I came a little late and I left a little early, and I asked a couple of you guys to sponsor me. And you weren't having any part of me, telling me, nope, it's girls with girls here. And so I really had to get it in spades. I'd gotten that I was powerless. I'd really gotten that. I knew that when I took that first drink, I could not tell you. Well, there was one first drink, and then it was forever, you know, a little over 10 years of never. I mean, I was never sober, not even in that hospital. So, and I could not predict my behavior. It broke my care button. It destroyed my conscience, as I've said. So I really finally fully conceded to my innermost self, okay? But that second half, that my thought life, and my sponsors always put that word in there, that my thought life had become unmanageable, I was not getting. I still thought I could do it myself. I did not want to be dependent. I did not want to bond or get close to any of you. And yet I watched what happened in Alcoholics Anonymous in that 6 months. I watched the miracles. I watched the people that came in when I came in, that got sponsors, that began to work steps, that got into service. I saw what happened to them. It was not happening for me. I was getting sicker and crazier. I was not able to get a job. I got the feeling my family was really happier if I left them alone. I'd become more like the raging maniac. I think they were happier when I was dead drunk somewhere and they didn't know where I was. It was like putting the square peg in the round hole kind of thing. And I finally, after 6 months, well, from August the 30th to the 17th of February, I had the day of days that brought me to my knees. The day of days. I ran into myself coming and going. The cops stopped me going the wrong way on a one-way street. I ran a red light, didn't get caught for that. I had a major rage attack in a supermarket because the line was so long in the checkout for limited stuff, you know, for under. And then somebody crowded in front of me, and I just went ballistic. And by the time I got home, I'd exhausted myself. And then I'd forgotten some piece of unimportant whatever, and I had a full-blown rage attack, the likes of which I had never known. And in that attack, it was as if my being exploded into just thousands of pieces. And the next thing I knew, I'm on my floor, and what I am seeing is just rubble and ruin. And in the middle of that rubble and ruin, an emaciated, starving person with this fully distended stomach and arms and legs that barely have skin on them. And I'm that kid. And the rubble and ruin around me is what I've been doing with my life. And I got the second half of step one in spades. In spades. I saw that the problem lay well localized between my ears, that drinking was only a symptom. And I had a motion picture. God gave me, that's when he came out of the deep freeze that moment and became a part of me, well, always was a part of me, but I let him out of the deep freeze, or he came out of the deep freeze. Anyway, he was there. This warm feeling just surged through me, and he gave me flashbacks in my lifetime from very early to current in which I could see that the problem lay well localized between my ears, that it was in my thinking, my perception. This is a disease of perception for me. I have never perceived life accurately. And I also got that as Diane thinketh, so she does feel. And as Diane feels, so she does act. So my thinking triggers my feelings, and my feelings trigger my actions. And it had been negative, negative, negative. And You know, I did not, you know, this feeling of my great friend within, I immediately called, and I remembered the line from We Agnostics Deep Down, within every man, woman, and child. That line came through. You guys had gotten through to me in some small measure. And I stayed in that position, curled up on my living room floor the rest of the night. Woke up the next morning cramped and cold. But I found my great friend within. He's been there ever since. Wherever I am, he is. And I knew what I had to do. It was a Tuesday, February the 18th, 1975. And I had to get to that women's meeting. I had to get myself a sponsor. And I had to start doing this deal. And that whole day, my whole focus was getting to that meeting and doing the impossible, as I shared with you earlier, asking Pat to sponsor me. My life turned around that day, absolutely turned around. Pat immediately shared with me that they went to meetings every day. Now, this is a tremendously strong group of women I just accidentally found, women that were in service to Alcoholics Anonymous, women that were sober from Jody, who got sober in 1957 in New York City. She was too awesome. She was too scary to even, she was Pat's sponsor. And when I looked at her, I just saw God. You know, it was, I mean, I couldn't imagine. She got sober really young, too. So that was beyond comprehension. But these women were all just on the firing lines of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Pat said to me, we go to a big book study on Monday nights. And, of course, Tuesday night is our women's meeting. And there's a step discussion meeting on Wednesday, another close women's meeting on Thursday, another big book study on Friday, a closed Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at 1 o'clock on Saturday, and a step tradition study meeting on Sunday night. And then I could go to all the other meetings that I wanted to. Yep, but what I got to do was to be sure I got there early to help set up and stay late to help clean up. And she also shared with me that making phone calls was very healthy, that the phone was the lifeline. Oh, my God. I made all kinds of phone calls out there drunk, but to another real human being with that kind of thing, that was quite incomprehensible. Then she also talked to me, you know, being an animal, literally, you know, I had no dietary habits, no eating or sleeping habits. I mean, I was absolutely undisciplined, period. I didn't know what it was to go to bed and stay in that all night long. I didn't know what it was to eat. I would have volcanic eruptions late in the afternoon, for example. She had the audacity. I mean, I went ballistic. Okay, this is what happened. I was supposed to go down to the hospital to see a friend with some other AA friends, and they didn't show up for me. They abandoned me. They went down to the hospital without me. Well, I got in my car, and in a blind rage, I drove down the San Tomas Expressway and out to Los Gatos, and I stormed into that hospital waiting room, and they were still waiting there to go in and see our friend, and I just erupted all over them. I just had an absolutely major, major volcanic attack, and in the middle of this reception area in the hospital waiting room, turned on my heel, marched out again, drove back up the road, you know, back home in a rage, didn't even stay to see the friend, and then had the presence of mind to call my sponsor. And she asked me what I'd had for breakfast. And this is 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, what does that have to do with a... She said, what did you have for breakfast? And I had to think a minute, and I thought, I think maybe a donut. And she said, that... A donut does not breakfast make. It's no wonder you're crazy. Your body has no fuel to go on. And she gave me this big, and I thought, oh, my God, this sobriety thing. I mean, you know, rah, 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 rah. So she literally ended up coming over to my house, and we did a house cleaning because there were stuff in cupboards and things that didn't need to be there. And she talked about the importance of starting the day with a good breakfast. Oh, my God, I'd never, you know, an animal doesn't eat except when, I don't know. So, that, you know, we just had all kinds of lessons. And then she looked at my place and she said, you know, every time I had a related, she called them related disorder, She would send me home to clean the bathroom because she'd seen my bathroom. And so she'd send me home to clean. She'd say, Diane, I want you to go home and clean your bathroom, particularly I want you to scrub the toilet. And I would just be, you know, she never had any, I thought, really concrete. Or she'd say to me, well, maybe we should give this one a week to see what our perspective. And usually by a week later, I couldn't even remember what it was that I had brought to her that was so incredibly all-consuming. She was amazing. I mean, she had an answer for everything, and it was always action, and it was always a related disorder, and that, you know, if I just stay sober today, and of course, at this point, she's trying to guide me through the steps. Now, I've already got step one nailed, and I really have seen, and she's pretty convinced, too, that I have come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sound thinking, sanity, sound thinking, because I had seen it happening in these hallowed halls. And I knew that the little tiny glimmer of light that I had gotten was, you know, and this new great friend within definitely was beginning to get a little different design on living. And then, you know, she also determined that lying on the floor that night, I had made that once-in-a-lifetime irrevocable decision to turn my will on my lives. And she emphasized lives with me. Because she said, you know, it's not just your life you've been in the business of trying to control and run. It's anybody else's that you've been emotionally attached to. You've determined that they were your servant, and they needed to do and read the script that you've written. And so, you know, that became the most incredibly important thing for me. That I make that, and it was, it was a once-in-a-lifetime irrevocable decision to turn my will and my lives over to the care. Now, care, she says, you're not giving anything away. God has been taking care of you in spite of you. Or you would have been dead in that hospital room. You would have killed the woman and her daughter. You would have killed yourself in the numerous suicide attempts. You would have been locked up still in the state of New Jersey. You've gotten away. You know where I did my crimes, the shoplifting on down. Never got caught. Cops were never there. Just had a whole heck of a lot of amends to make. And so she reminded me that God had always been taking care of me, that I was his kid, and that even in my darkest hours when I was being the naughtiest, he loved me just as much. That was incomprehensible, that God forgives and loves, and it was up to me to forgive me and others. Wow. And then as I understood him, she told me I'd never understand the infinite, the almighty, the wonderful God, that word in italics simply means God as I personally understand him, God as I personally relate to him and identify with him today. So made that decision to turn my will and my lives over to the care of God as I understand him. And that has remained for me inviolate. I practice it every day the best I can. But that was a once-in-a-lifetime irrevocable decision that I made, and my life has not been the same since. It took me clear around through my first year that even to let me be secretary of my women's group, and I had not really finished the steps yet, but I think they determined that it was terribly important that I get into service. And they let me, in the meantime, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm seeing individuals in meetings that just have a light about them, you know, an enthusiasm, a joy, a specialness. And, you know, every time I go to a meeting, I'm looking to see if one of them are there, you know, your special men and women. And so I'm sent to the secretary's workshop, and I walk in to learn about how to be a secretary and about the various service entities in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am impacted again, and it's one again those moments of truth, those unbelievably special moments. I walk in, and I swear to you that in that room were all of my godlights, all of them. It was like they posseed up to surprise me, or to, you know, show me, hey, this is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You get on the firing line and you're of service and you're a light. We're about 5% of the population in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're here. And I sat in absolute awe. And in that moment of truth, I knew what I was going to be. In that moment of truth, boy, I dove in and started writing that four-step. Boy, I wanted to be part of that posse. But they were there to share with us about intergroup, general service, public information, cooperation with the professional community, hospitals and institution. There was no Bridging the Gap or contact service yet, but all of the ways in which we keep AA alive and well and growing. And I left that room that night, not only to be the best secretary that women's meeting ever had, and in that I learned about rotation, because 6 months later when they were done with me, I thought they should be begging me to stay, and they were just summarily dismissing me, your term's up, move on, and I am just beside myself because nobody has done the job like I did it. In the meantime, I haven't even taken my fifth step yet. Yes, I was almost. No, wait a minute. I think I took it a month before. But I did dive in. And, you know, this was a really rough deal for me, this fifth. My sponsor kept saying, it's in the book, it's in the book, it's in the big book. Except that, remember, there's three columns. There's also the fourth. Now, after I'd gotten a bit into that fourth step, my sponsor asked me how it was going, and she asked me about the fourth column, and I said, well, there's three, the guys that did it, and what they did, and what it affected. I got that all down. She said, well, your part. She had to help me get into my part. She had to help me get into all my dishonesty, manipulation, use of, I mean, I had such a part. But you know, the minute she got me going there, as I had about 21 people on my list at that point, the minute she got me going there, a miracle happened. My world turned around. Because instead of being the innocent victim, I became the roaring tornado. The people that had been so awful and harmed me all of a sudden became innocent victims. I was stepping on people's toes all over the place. I was making decisions based on self, placing myself in a position to be hurt. What a transformation. What an incredible, I just dove through the rest of that fourth step. I could not, the fifth step came like the watering hole in the desert at that point, because I got it, oh my God. And you know, the thing is that I realized I'd found the enemy right here, and there was something I could do about it. And in sitting down with my sponsor in that glory, and I remember December the 18th, 1975, she gave me an entire day a week before Christmas, with everything going on that time of year. And she did not faint, like I told you. She did not throw up. She didn't run from the room. She simply shared back with dignity and grace. And when I left her home that evening, I felt like I could fly. You know, the self-loathing, hatred, degradation. God, for the first time in my life, I really was beginning to like Diane. And I really believed that I could be a child of dignity, value, and worth. I could be a channel of God's grace, that I had a message that my deep, dark, ugly past could be the greatest tool, greatest gift I owned when used in God's hands. And in thinking about that driving home, I all of a sudden got overwhelmed. And I had not cried, really cried, since I was seven. And I had to pull over to the side of the road. And I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I sobbed. And I sobbed so hard I could hardly breathe. And I barely had time to get home and do what she told me to do, review the first five proposals, and then beat it off to that Thursday women's meeting where they called on me. Now, I had never shared. Get this. December the 18th, 1975. I came in August 30th, 74. I had never opened my mouth. I couldn't even read. I think you gave me that 15th, and I couldn't read. So they call, it was step four, and my sponsor, I know, must have told him, because they called on me, and I got up there, and I actually articulated a sentence or two. I just said a little. And then I sat down with such an emotional detox, you have no imagine. I sat down and collapsed. In my head roared, what did I say? What didn't I say? What did they think? What didn't they think? I don't know if any of you have ever been there. But I went home in a complete emotional behind. I mean, it took me several hours to recover from having said a couple of sentences in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the miracle had happened. And on that day, I knew that I was here to stay. I knew that no one was ever going to take AA away from me. You see, all my life, those gremlins, those head weasels that had ruled me, had taken from me, I thought, not to, had kept me from really doing or becoming what I wanted to be. I had no discipline. I had all these dreams all over the place, but I never followed through. And everything I tried to do never succeeded. And I was so afraid that I'd lose AA, that they would come in and take me, and that I'd die out there, and I didn't want to die anymore. I'd wanted to die the day before Dr. Terrell took me to detox. I'd wanted to die. I didn't care anymore. You know, I was scared of guns, or I would have used one. I never held a gun in my life. I've tried other methods of killing myself. At that point, I remember thinking, I'm just going to drink to death. And now I want to live, and I want to be a part of this incredible fellowship. But I was scared. I was so scared. And after that fifth step and that sobbing on the way home, I knew, I absolutely knew I was never leaving AA, and I was never getting off the firing lines either. I was going to be of service one day at a time, no matter what. You know, my sponsor explained to me about this sixth step, and she told me, you know, okay, Diane, lid's off the garbage can. There's the garbage. What are you going to do about it? God's no magic celestial bellhop. Fifth step doesn't remove the garbage, it just exposes it. God's great gift to you is a gift of awareness, period. He's not going to do anything for you that you cannot do for yourself. I really thought that doing that fourth and fifth step, that poof, it would all be gone. All of the, you know, stuff that I had done. And she said, no, you have to change your behavior. This is the toughest step of all. Entirely ready goes beyond willingness. Your willingness is a little head business. Entirely ready is deep gut conviction. You know, my husband talks about St. Augustine, who wants to be a saint, but he doesn't quite want to give up his little problem with lust. So he's saying to God, you know, God, I really need to be a saint. I really want to be a saint. But, you know, I got this problem with lust, love the women, and I want to give it up, but not yet. So don't remove it yet. I'll let you know when I'm ready. Doesn't work that way here. You know, I had to be entirely ready to change behavior. And this is the most challenging step for me of all. Because, you know, it's only through repeated humiliations we learn anything about humility. And humbly is what step seven is all about. And for me, God gets in. Now, see, what God really does here is remove the obsessions of my mind or moderate them. You know, in cases of my instincts, you know, I'm always going to have them. So it's a moderation. It's a leveling of the pride. It's a balancing of fear. It's a balance, which, of course, is, I think, achieved through, you know, the growth steps. How well am I living today? Step 10. My constant getting to know my great friend within better through prayer and meditation. Step 11. And through losing myself in life, trying to carry this message. And of course, practicing these incredible principles, not only within our hallowed halls, where I think it's quite easy most of the time. Once in a while in service, there's a challenge. But most of the time, I just, you know, don't have a problem with anybody in AA anymore. I love everybody. Let God's kids grow up along with me. But out there, and on my tennis team, in my tennis world, and with family stuff, you know, there, life presents its challenges. So I am burrowed into step six all the time, keeping life in balance. But I remember coming to my sponsor in a rage, telling her that I'm still telling lies. I was a pathological liar. It just was natural for me to make things sound less than they really were or embellish them. And I'll never forget the phone call, because I'm having a temper tantrum at God, and my sponsor goes, wow, so you don't want to lie anymore. And I said, no, but why, you know, and she said, then stop lying. And I said, but I can't. And she said, that's not the operative word, Diane. The operative word is won't. You won't stop lying because you're still getting something out of it. You won't stop gossiping because you're still getting something out of it. And she set me on a path that was really mean. She said to me, well, you know, God's given you the awareness. You know you're lying. Isn't that exciting? She was excited for me. And She said, the next time you go to lie to somebody, you start to lie, you just stop yourself and apologize and let them know that's not the truth. I'm not telling you the truth. This is the truth. I wanted to say, but I can't do that. I didn't dare. But let me tell you how humiliating, but it worked. It worked. And I never know when God stepped in. I wake up to it later. Oh, my God, he has removed that obsession of my mind. My insides balance my outsides, because at first in anything new, my instincts, my inner instincts are still wanting to lie, for example, or wanting to gossip. And then all of a sudden, there is that magical balance where I'm just telling the truth, and it's not acceptable to be talking about somebody. And so through practicing right behavior, step six, God does his part. Step seven, removes, and for me, it's the obsessions of my mind, where the problem is, where the root of all evil is, right here. Steps eight and nine were another incredible, incredible happening for me. You know, my sponsor wanted me to look anew at the people in my life. She said, she wasn't one of those that you go back and just copy that fifth step. She said, there are people that were not there that you become aware of that you're not resentful toward. And there are people that maybe are there. I want a whole new list. And she had me write about each and every person that I needed to sit down and make right with. And we spent another day talking about these innocent victims in my life, because believe me, there were a lot of them. And her strong feeling was, wherever possible, you want to face off and sit down with a heart-to-heart talk. She felt like anything else was a cop-out unless it absolutely wouldn't work. And her magical formula was, I thanked each person when I sat down with them for their patience and tolerance and love and kindness, for literally being a saint in my life and putting up with me. Part two, it's like that essay that I had those kids write. There's the introductory paragraph, then there's the main body, and then there's the concluding paragraph. Main body was admission of harm done without getting into detail. She said, you don't want to open any old wounds and pour salt in. Like I said to my mom and my dad, I've not been the daughter you deserved. I fully recognize that. We know that. I've caused a lot of heartache and a lot of pain. Paragraph three, but I'm here today to be the best daughter on planet Earth you will ever know. I'm here to do every single thing I can for you. And all you got to do is let me know what you need me to do. In the meantime, right up, I was holding my dad when he died. My sisters had gone with my mom because they knew death was near. I had that privilege to cradle him in my arms when he took his last breath, and then to lie with him to try to keep him warm, so that when my mom and my sisters got back, he wouldn't be a cold corpse. That was incomprehensible. You could never have gotten me to believe that in a million years I could do something like that. I hospiced my mommy through her dying. That was the most challenging month of my entire life, to watch her die by inches. And we were there, my beautiful husband, Perry, lest I should forget. I married my soulmate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't deserve him. It's like living with a saint. Anybody that knows me and knows him, you know that's true. We met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've been trucking side by side for 28 glorious years, married, 29 together. I didn't keep a hostage for more than a minute before I changed men like underwear. And I met the most beautiful man on planet Earth, whom I did not deserve, I believed. And God drew us together, I think, for what we can give to life, traveling side by side with our own sponsors, our own sponsees, our own service commitments. And we've never taken one step off of the firing lines. We haven't grabbed our golden nugget of life and run away with it. We have tried to be of service in every way we can, with phones ringing and commitments. And, you know, we're off to CTF Soledad State Prison and Salinas Valley, sometimes six times, and it's a 90-mile drive each way, it's 180 miles round trip, sometimes six times a month. And it's a privilege to live with Perry. It's a privilege. I love you. Anyway, so he helped me through my mommy loves dying. And you know, she'd had a horrible cross to bear with me because she felt like she'd made so many mistakes on the first child. And I think I was 15 years sober when she finally came down off the cross like I asked her to. She'd run away from home for her birthday, and I decided I was going to surprise her. And I got all the girls I sponsored together with her significant others, and we threw her a birthday party. And she walked into that restaurant totally shocked. I mean, she just couldn't. I mean, there were all balloons and presents, and all of my girls dressed up, dressed to the nines with their significant others. And she stood in the doorway and literally came to tears. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, Diane A., here are all the beautiful daughters you could never have. One of the things I'd done as a kid was get mauled by a dog. I went after the dog. And in the massive radiation and stuff, she later felt that I could never have kids. Well, possibly not. I was never pregnant. And a good thing, too. I mean, babies born to the like of me would not have been a good deal. But my mother had really carried that burden, really carried it, as if she were somehow responsible for my not getting pregnant. And that night, and she said, "Oh, Diane A., here are all the beautiful daughters you could never have." She went around and embraced every woman in that room and thanked them for my life and thanked them for her daughter. That was a moment. I remember once we were shopping and she picked up a purse, and I could tell she just thought the purse was absolutely the end all. And she put it back, and a woman took it back and they locked it behind this glass thing. It was a very expensive purse. I think it was like 400 and something. And I went back and got that purse. I asked Perry to keep an eye, where is it? And I went back the next day and bought it for her, and they wrapped it up and I brought it home. And because, see, I owed her a lot of money, but I couldn't tell her that I'd stolen, taken money, misused money, would have added more harm. Step 9 says very clearly, wherever possible, not when, where. And so, you know, unless what I should do would harm other people. And that would have brought a lot more harm to her to know fully what I had done. I could never do it. I never wanted her around when I did a speaker's meeting because I just, you know, you don't want to harm. Anyway, so I gave her the box and she opened it and she just lost it. She looked at me and she said, "Diane A., why? I mean, what's this for?" She was just flabbergasted. And I was down on my knees sitting at her feet and I said, "Because I love you. Is that good enough? Because I love you." And she slipped down off that chair and dissolved into my arms, and we held each other, and I knew we were good. And we were good, you know, into her dementia and the years that we were down there. I called her every single night about the same time, and if somebody else called at that time, she would tell them, "This is Diane A.'s time." She'd pick up the phone and go, "Hi, Diane A.," and if it were not I, she would, "But where's Diane A.?" It was so cute. Then this last, you know, my mom and dad were both remarried, and just this last week, I had the privilege of my stepmom, who's 94 years old, 94 in September, has decided she wants to come to, she's now in California, she wants to leave Tucson after 65 years and move here. And she's got a son who lives in Santa Clara. She's very close to him, and she's very close to me and Perry. So she determined 2 months ago she wants to move here for the rest of her life. This is huge, guys, huge. So last week, a week ago today, we were moving her things, 65 years worth, into a moving van and getting her ready to survive the trip back to California, first by car to Phoenix and then by plane here. Settling her into a little retirement community near us and supervising the unloading of her things on Monday, which were twice as much as this little apartment would hold. So we've spent this week trying to pare down, but when you're 94, you don't want to let go of anything. There are memories, memories, and memories. So I've really been in touch with how much you guys have taught me. The moving van people, for example, on Saturday, this is all contingent on them getting her stuff and getting it there on Monday, so she's not without. She was in a guest apartment for a couple of days, not without her stuff. And the moving truck broke, and there was no moving van. And my girlfriend, my sponsee, was just beside herself because she was, and this is you guys now, this is you guys and God, just this moment of, oh my God, what are we going to do? How are we going to get our stuff out of here? This does not come from me, okay? I just went out there and I took the moving guy, David. I had my hands on his shoulders first, and then I took his hands, his face in my hands. And I said, David, I see a young man with integrity. I see a young man who's honest. I just need you to go and get whatever vehicle you need to get to move my mom's stuff. Do whatever you need to do. I'll pay you whatever the issue was over money. I will pay you. I said, the laborer is worthy of his hire. One book says that. Our book mentions it. Bill Wilson mentions it. Just go do the deal. And then I took him in my arms and I hugged him. And from then it was green light, go. And they had that stuff packed up by 6:30 at night. And they had it here at Cupertino on Monday afternoon at 12:30 and totally unloaded by 4:30. And then it's just the patience and tolerance and love and kindness with my little Mama Dorothy. Just letting her be Mama Dorothy and keep what she needs to keep. And so again, you know, we are so gifted here. I don't know if you guys know this, but I sure think we are just real treasures in God's world. I don't think we're any special in the sense of God's kids. I really think that we're all God's kids, okay? But when I had that spiritual awakening halfway through my ninth step, one of the things that really impacted me was that, you know, as God's kids, we're all created out of his love, each and every one of us. And it's for one reason and one reason only, I believe. And that's to be about his business. I really do believe he creates us so that we can be channels to which he goes forth into his creation so that he can experience himself through us. And so even though all his kids are his kids, I think those of us that have found our way into Alcoholics Anonymous are blessed. Because I think we've been born, I know we've been born out of the land of the living dead, out of darkness into light. And we've been given that great message of hope to carry to those who still suffer. And I just ask you, where else on planet Earth has there ever been, is there today, or will there ever be the glorious opportunities that we have in AA to be about God's business? You know, I just think we're so blessed. I feel blessed. I feel so grateful, so very grateful to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous after more than 32 years, more than ever. My desire to be of service is stronger than ever. My heart sings every time I get to go to Mariposa or Elmwood or Salinas Valley or CTF Soledad State Prison. I meet those lifers down there and they carry an unbelievable message to me that they can be godlights in that prison, that they can lead lives of dignity, value, and worth as members of Alcoholics Anonymous in that prison, even though they are never getting out. Some of them that have been down well over 20 years, numerous attempts at parole, are facing the parole board being turned down, and yet they come in over 100 strong at CTF Soledad on our first Wednesday back from the Edge Group, over 100 strong messengers of hope that then go out and infiltrate that prison and make life better for that warden on down. How blessed are we, I believe. How blessed. Anyway, thank you for allowing me to share. God bless.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions, toll free 1-877-893-2777 or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.